And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Connan.
Yeah, good afternoon, Phil.
And really happy today. We're going to have an important guest, Keith Bolander. He's sitting next to me, so I mispronounce everything. And he's written a great book, Cuba Under Siege, American Policy and Revolution, the Revolution and Its People. I want to announce that a different book list has got a lecture coming up on Wednesday, June 17th at 7 p.m., and it's going to be at Beth Satoon, 612 Markham Street, and it is Maximilian Forte. He's written a book, Slouching Towards CERT, about NATO's attack on Libya, which may have some relevance to our discussion with Keith Bolander. But that's Wednesday, June 19, 7 p.m. It's sponsored by Beth Satoon and a different book list, and it's at 612 Markham Street, Bathurst and Bloor. I really hope everybody attends. Right at the tag of the show, we're going to be talking to Mr. Lotayev of GazaArk.org, and they have managed to nearly complete work on the new boat that they're going to intend to challenge the blockade, Israel's blockade of Gaza from the inside out rather than from the other way around. They're going to take products produced in Gaza, Palestine, and they're going to go out with these products and to see how far they can sail. At any rate, it's an important matter. We will catch up with Mr. Lotayev at the end of the show. But right now, I want to welcome Keith Bolander, who's written his great book, Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution, and Its People. So, Keith, good to see you.
Thank you, Phil. It's always nice to talk to you, and it's good to be right here in the studio.
You were at an important meeting on Saturday, apropos of your book. You were speaking at Pace University in New York.
Yeah, the Left Forum Conference, it's held once a year. It's one of the largest conferences for left-thinking progressives, and they often have a lot of Cuban panels. And I was on one talking about current American policy against Cuba and how it relates to the continuing saga of the Cuban Five.
Yeah. I guess I want to ask you one question about the Five before we move on to talking about the book, and that is there's always interesting – it's a great battle, I have to say. If there's any hope for the American Republic, it's in the struggles over their own laws and whatnot. But they've uncovered a rather important detail. That is that the U.S. government actually paid journalists to write demeaning and dishonest articles. Is that right? They're going to court about that.
Yeah, one of the organizations, the National Committee to Free the Five, has spent the last few years trying to get this information, specifically of these Miami-based journalists, many who wrote for the Miami Herald, who it was revealed were paid by the American government to write stories negative about Cuba, which a Miami journalist doesn't really need to be paid.
Boy, when you're paid,
write negative stories.
What do you want? Exclamation points?
The American government felt it was important to make sure that the public knew that these were spies, and these stories were put in the papers before the trial had even started, and a couple of them were paid substantial amount of monies to write not only about the Cuban Five, but about Cuba agents in general, and of course the continuation of the propaganda against Cuba. So, you know, the committee of the National Committee to Free the Five has positioned itself that these stories prejudiced the trial, which is just one aspect.
And by the way, wouldn't that go to the point that the lawyers opened with, which is a call for a change of venue? And they said, "Oh no, you don't need a change of venue. Now you produce evidence, I guess, solid evidence that the journalists were paid."
That was remarkable that they didn't change the venue. I mean, that's a standard judicial procedure, and the judge just refused to understand. Well, I'm sure she knew, but she just refused to make the decision to change the venue. Mm-hmm. And it was quite incredible. And then you hear stories about the jurists were being followed, that their license plates were being taken pictures of. So there was tremendous pressure, yeah, right before the trial started to make sure these five were convicted, and they certainly were.
Give them a fair trial and hang them, as they say in America. West. You know, they culturally prepare Americans for this kind of thinking. They do often. There's that little speech has been in a lot of American movies.
Well, and the thing is, if you do talk to an American who even knows of the case, the immediate response is, well, they were spies and they got what they deserved. Mm-hmm. So the Americans have a tremendous propaganda system, and it has worked and is working very well in the case of the Cuban Five.
Yeah. Well, that speaks to your title, Cuba Under Siege. By the way, it seems to me you really nailed it down. You have a picture here of a great power who wants to make sure that the smaller power, the state, has to obey. And and the smaller state disagrees, and then you have 50 years of what we've got. You want to talk about the siege? You lay it out very nicely in the opening of your book. You tell the history of sieges, and some work and some don't. But
yeah, thank you. The idea of the book was to bring an overall perspective of what American policy has meant to Cuban society in a negative sense. The general perception is it's the embargo, the economic embargo. The Cubans call it a blockade, which has had a tremendous negative impact on the development of Cuban society and its ability to develop certain aspects that they're the social programs. But it's not just the embargo; it's the nonstop propaganda. It's the extraterritoriality effect of the laws that affect Canadians as well. It's all these elements. It's the ability to portray the Cuban Revolution in 100% negative terms. Mm. And it's been going on for 50 years, as you said. So the book tried to examine how has that affected society in a whole, but also the individual Cuban. It's approximately 70% of every Cuban alive in Cuba has lived under the embargo. They have no other experience. And the Cuban officials say, well, you can't judge us on our shortcomings or our failures to a certain extent without taking the embargo and the American policy in its totality. Yeah. The other aspect is there's this long history of terrorism against Cuba that has cost the lives of thousands of Cuban individuals that very few people know about. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the effect of American society right now after one horrendous terrorist attack in 9/11 and the steps that the American government had to take as far as surveillance, as far as security. Well, then you extrapolate that to 100 times what Cuba has faced. Yes. And these acts of terrorism were conducted in the vast majority by Cuban Americans in the United States, in Florida. The American government knew and in many cases supported and have done nothing about it. So then how does a society, a small society, developing a new way to develop society under a revolutionary regime, how does it protect itself and its citizens under this unrelenting hostility?
Yeah. Well, you know, Cuba's been such a problem, a big question mark at the end of the Florida, because it raises the problem of not who is Cuba, but who is the United States. There is a problem that we're drifting into, and your book really details it very nicely, that the U.S., for example, insists on extraterritoriality for its own security. Well, as you say, superpower. So a country of 11 million, at one time I remember when we used to call it 6 million, but now they're 11, which shows that they are thriving despite this. So they if they are to survive, they have to exercise some intelligence work themselves because they know from whence bad things are coming, and they work to do that. But the U.S. has a power grid over them and over the earth now, we're learning, that it does not permit anybody to question. And frankly, they are drifting toward a crisis, are they not? They're always talking about Cuba's got to change. Well, there's a lot of countries now say, no, you've got to change, you, the United States. Because, well, we learned over the weekend from Jeff, it's his name, did I get his name right yet? Glenn Greenwald, my favorite Guardian author, that the U.S. is listening to everybody. That would include Canada, by the way. And I haven't heard any Canadians react. But the U.S. is monitoring and manipulating every capital on the earth.
And it's an interesting point because America after 9/11 almost immediately instituted the Patriot Act and then developed these systems to survey their own citizens for their sake of security. And the majority of Americans accept that because the perception is, well, if I'm not doing anything wrong, what difference does it make if the government is reading my emails?
Right.
So the government, and not just the American government, but every country throughout history has used national security threats or war to institute these security measures that do restrict civil rights. Mm-hmm. So Cuba, a small country under threat of the world's greatest power, and with all this evidence, it's not just perception, the terrorism acts are real, the embargo is real, the extraterritoriality is real. Mm-hmm. How do they protect themselves?
Yes.
They do it like any other country is in the history has done by instituting security systems.
And the media here calls that a police state.
Exactly. Well, now we're finding out how much of a police state the Americans are instituting.
Yes. And
this
puts them in the shade.
This news, this recent news is interesting, but it's been going on for the last whatever, how many years since 9/11. It didn't just happen last month. It was going on under Bush.
Yes.
Obama has maintained it.
Maybe
increased it. But it's all the perception of we have to keep our citizens safe against a perceived threat. The perceived threat for the Americans is Islamic radicalism. Mm. There's no perceived threat for the Cubans because they know where the threat is coming from and they can verify it.
And they're not a Muslim country.
No, and they're being punished far worse.
But they're still on the terror list, right?
Well, it's the latest. I'm glad you brought that up. It's the latest example of American intransigence against Cuba because just last week, the State Department announced their latest report on international terrorism, and Cuba remained on the list of states who sponsor terrorism. And it is so galling for the Cuban government because of their experience having been a victim of terrorism for so long to find themselves on this ridiculous list of states who sponsor terrorism with absolutely no justification.
Yeah. Well, and there we have the issue. And you were at Pace University and you were looking at it right in the eye. This is the issue of American gullibility. This is really frightening. 300 and some million people who accept the silliest arguments or excuses for the conduct of their government.
But that's
that's
a great comment on how effective American propaganda is.
Yes.
They say the Cubans are good at propaganda or you know, the socialist states are good. No, the Americans are far more efficient at that type of propaganda.
Yeah, they're the champs, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unquestionable champs. Again, I want to say, this is Keith Bolander, by the way, and the book is Cuba Under Siege, and it's Palgrave. I forget the other half of the name of the publisher, Palgrave Macmillan. Mm-hmm. By the way, Keith has written Voices from the Other Side, an oral history of terrorism against Cuba. Both these books, everybody should get a copy of. I happen to know there's a bunch of them at a different book list, so that's one place you could start. This book, by the way, is very persuasive. It's full of facts. This is a very well-written book. I congratulate you. I really do think everybody should have it. But I was thinking, you know, a subhead for the book, you could have borrowed from C. Wright Mills, Listen, Yankee. and he wrote this wonderful propaganda book, C. Wright Mills. He visited Cuba, something you recommend as a medicinal thing. America, people should travel, see for themselves. And
exactly.
Reach their own conclusion. Now, he did make a trip there. He came back all pumped up. And he was a high-powered sociologist at Columbia University, a friend of Jacques Barzun and all that. So he wrote Listen, Yankee. And nobody listened. But here's my issue. With C. Wright Mills was addressing the American liberal intelligentsia, which is still, I notice, being addressed. At the end of your book, we're still discussing whether or not a good guy, Obama, you know, or a reasonable fellow like Kerry, or Joe Biden, all of whom they always say, "Oh, he understands; he just can't do anything." But anyhow, that's where we are. Mills tried to persuade Arthur Schlesinger. You talk about him in the book.
There's all sorts of historical evidence that the Americans know this policy is ridiculous; that it serves no purpose. But it's not based on rationality. It's based on the historical relationship between Cuba and the United States going back to the Second War of Independence, the Spanish-American War, and Americans' perceptions that they own Cuba, and they still can't understand why the Cubans kicked them out. Why right. Fidel was so angry with the Americans.
Well, or
and they still can't understand that. They can't get over it.
Yeah, or they say, well, of course you kicked out Ike, but after all, Kennedy's nice.
Well, and Obama's a perfect example. Before, when he was running for president, his website said the Cuban policy is a failure, it's a disaster, it needs to be changed, we need to engage. 50 years has done nothing, and there's no sense of maintaining this ridiculous policy. Well, as soon as he got into be president, He did make some changes. He let Cuban Americans travel to Cuba without restrictions, and he increased the licensed travel for Americans, and that's it. And then when he was questioned about Cuba, he said, well, they haven't done anything to warrant any change in the embargo. Meanwhile, the changes in Cuba have been unbelievably dramatic over the last 2 years, and Obama's position is exactly the same as every other American position, which is we're not going to change how we treat Cuba. So it's the Nixon called it a mental sickness over Cuba, and there's no other country that has ever been treated this way by the United States. So there's no rational reason.
Yeah. Let me nominate Haiti with France. They seem to resent somebody defying them.
Well, and the American perception is we bring so much good to the world. How could anyone be against us? And if you are against us, by definition, you're evil.
Yeah.
And that's so much of a continuation of why the Americans say, well, we're not going to change our Cuban policy until the Cubans change. Well, the Cubans have to change completely under American demands.
What they mean is, under tutelage.
Yes,
right.
Because
somebody from Harvard, and the IMF has to be in Havana helping you work this out.
Because what you've had for the last 50 years under the revolution has no worth.
Yeah.
Only when you come back to our embrace that we'll forgive you.
Yeah. Well, now let's talk about that. I once had the honor of traveling with an American novelist, long forgotten now, named Truman Nelson in Cuba. And I missed a chance to go see Che Guevara, to go with Truman Nelson to visit a mental hospital, which was being built. And he took me by the arm and said to me, Phil, you judge a country not by the richest people. You judge it by how the society treats the poorest. He said, you see this? It had been the wall of the old institution in Havana was all been torn down except one, and there was a barred window about 12 feet from the ground. And what we were in was, it looked like a golf course, in the sense it was beautiful grounds and grass and flowers and all that, and smaller buildings scattered. Very human, one-floor environment. And, well, anyway, it stayed with me. Okay, this is very early in the revolutionary period, but already a major event medically being achieved by Cuba.
And you consider what they've had to go through, not only with the embargo, but after the collapse of the Soviet Union and their economy hit the floor, they lost 40% of their GDP and 80% of their trade, and they were still able to maintain, to the best of their ability, their social justice programs, including free medical care, including education. It's very easy to criticize the quality of it, but they've still maintained it, as opposed to certain first world countries that don't even have universal health care. But
what about the idea of using this argument that, it is in the interest of the broad American public to listen to and learn from Cuba? In other words, because if Cuba were to say, you're right, okay, yeah, no, we shouldn't have free medical care, we shouldn't have free university, we should be more like you, That really wouldn't be a very good message to be received by the popular people, the public of America, which is trying to get Medicare, trying to get reduced fees, let alone, or a freezing of fees. I mean, it would be a setback for them, a loss, right? Because they'd say, you see, that system doesn't work. We need to give it up here. Any thought about it? Because Cuba's found to give it up.
Well, when I'm in the States, which I was just in New York, and you start a conversation with Americans about health care, and it's incredible how they present the case that universal health care isn't a good thing. And they comment quite negatively about Canada's universal health care. So again, it gets back to how the Americans are so well trained by their government.
Well, it's wall to wall, isn't it?
It is. And it's
you give an example of a nice Venezuelan gentleman who knows something about baseball who said, "Oh, I admire Fidel Castro. He's the manager of the Miami whatever."
And no more.
And they nearly lynched him.
Well, and he only said it in the context of he admired Fidel for being able to survive all the assassination attempts. He didn't say he admired Fidel as a great leader. He just said this guy's got a lot of mojo going. And even something as innocent as that caused such an uproar.
Cost him his job. Recall that when Pete Rose was giving up his manager job at Cincinnati Red, they said to him, "Well, you're going to retire. What are you going to do?" He said, "You know, I'd like to visit Cuba and see how they develop such great baseball players. And maybe I could teach and maybe I could learn." He was then hit with gambling and taxes. And I always thought, Pete, it was because of that interview. The New York Times featured that interview many years ago. I circled his name and said, "Pete, you're in big trouble."
And look what happened.
It's
funny. I write in the book that the key to everything, to end the hostility and embargo, is the travel restrictions. If you end the travel restrictions that let the Americans come and see for themselves,
hallelujah,
you will end the embargo, you will end the hostility, because then they won't have to rely on the government or the right wing telling them what Cuba reality is. They can see for themselves.
Challenge Americans to be free.
Yes.
At the moment, American people are not fighting for their freedom to travel.
And in particular, since the Cuban government eliminated a lot of the bureaucracy for Cubans to travel, the only travel restrictions between the two countries is on the American side now.
Yeah. So who's the free country?
Well.
Yes, that's rather. You probably remember this. Jessica Mitford's son, Jessica Mitford, a wonderful American author. Well, she was one of the Mitfords from England. But anyhow, she lived in Berkeley and husband was a progressive lawyer. She passed on. Her son is, I understand, a piano tuner or piano expert of some type. He makes them. So he took 12, 15 grand pianos to Cuba and gave them to Cuba and then came back to the United States and turned himself in for the reward. But they refused to arrest him.
So they didn't do anything?
No, I think they realized what you're saying.
Because there's so many cases of incidences like that where a little old lady goes down to ride a bicycle in Cuba, comes back, and all of a sudden is facing a fine of $10,000.
Well, she's not the daughter of Jessica Mitford. Yeah.
And then it's found out that the OFAC, the Office of Foreign Asset Control, has 10 times more agents working on violations of Cuban travel than they do on tracking down terrorist funding. So it's incredible how the Americans just cannot let go.
Yeah. No, it's like a psychological battle where they would feel diminished if they treated someone as an equal.
In this case, definitely.
I mean,
they can treat Vietnam, which they had a war for and had an embargo against Vietnam, and now they're most favored trading nation.
Yes. And Vietnam vets go and visit.
Exactly. There's no travel restrictions to go to Vietnam.
Yes.
And I don't think there's any travel restrictions to go to North Korea. Not that you want
maybe
to.
If Cuba would develop an anti-China policy, perhaps they would be. That's a very interesting thing. And I have to say, that's a weak point in my memory here of reading your book. They've tried so many things on Fidel, who has to be one of the. First of all, this is a remarkable figure in human history. Now, you could make a cult of him, but he isn't a cult. But actually quite a remarkable figure, rather like Abraham Lincoln, I'd say, in a sense that he just was able to handle the entire file from the top to the bottom and could do it himself. It didn't need a bunch of secretaries. And they tried many moves on him, all types, including the one you mentioned, which was the most devastating. It was when the Soviet Union decided they were going to fold up shop and Gorbachev was going to sign some papers. And persuade, by the way, some of his comrades to give up in the sense that he visited Romania, kissed him goodbye, went to East Germany, kissed him goodbye, went to Czechoslovakia, kissed him goodbye. None of these guys realized it was goodbye forever. But then he came to Fidel and gave him a kiss, and Fidel didn't kiss him back. And everybody said, well, now Fidel's going to be gone. Of course, the last time I saw Gorbachev, he was doing a pizza commercial during a Super Bowl. But now, isn't it important that he faced, not just from the right but allegedly from the left, people who tried to bring him down.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, it was guaranteed that the revolution in Cuba wouldn't last more than 6 months. In fact, there were many books, one in particular that said Castro's Final Hour, and that book was written 15, 20 years ago, so it's been a long time. But it's been a long series of, okay, if the Americans only do this, then the revolution will end. They still haven't understood the basic reality is that the majority of the people in Cuba, despite their complaints, despite their desire for changes, support the revolution and the leadership. The Americans have always said, no, all we have to do is invade at the Bay of Pigs and the Cubans will rise up and get rid of Fidel. All we have to do is put an economic embargo and make things so bad on the Cuban people that they'll rise up and get rid of Fidel. Now all we have to do, that the Soviet Union's over, we're just going to tighten the screws a bit.
Tighten the screws.
With Helms-Burton and Torricelli Law, and then there's no way they can survive. Well,
they survived because they wanted to survive.
Because they wanted to survive. But the American policy, the American strategy experts cannot understand that basic tenet that in the majority – the revolution is still supported. You go to Cuba and you can talk to every Cuban who will have a complaint and an opinion on how to make things better, which is entirely different from someone who's saying, no, we want to completely destroy the system and let the Americans come back. Mm-hmm. The American perception is the Cubans are just waiting for the gates of the castle to be open and the Americans can come in.
This is Keith Bolander. The book is Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution, and Its Peoples. Terrifically, I love the footnotes, let's put it that way. And it's very persuasive, well argued. But it brings out a lot of thoughts here and information that can be applied elsewhere. For example, you quote one of the most devilish individuals, sorry, his name won't come to mind, Mr. Noriega, the State Department guy, who said, well, you know, that we have people who want stability in Cuba. They say they want stability, but we do not want stability. Chaos is our friend.
In the context of the only way America's will be imposed is through that chaos. And there's such a long history of quotes from American officials saying, "Oh yeah, we want to starve the Cubans. We only want them to have one pair of shoes for 18 months. Oh, yeah, we know Fidel's popular, but we're going to make things so bad for the Cubans that they'll just throw out their government just to ease the pain.
Until they howl.
And the perception is, well, the policy is to free the Cuban people, where the American strategists and the American policymakers knew exactly what they were doing and why they were doing it and to which end.
Yes, but I'm applying it to contemporary Syria, which, by the way, I'm not reading Cuban commentary, but I'll bet they are noticing all of this. So what is this leader of Syria supposed to do? He gets people come into his country financed by oil kingdoms and together with the United States, and he says, well, I wouldn't mind talking, but they don't. They said, no, we want more weapons, and we want you to go. Well, I mean, that's just a chaos formula. Obviously, you can't talk to a bunch of madmen, so what are you to do?
But to achieve which purpose? To achieve America's
will, the dominance.
Exactly.
They must be seen to be dominant.
And the Americans are very easy to switch from you're my friend today and my enemy tomorrow.
And they can be, as you have the Kennedys, by the way, properly painted. There's always been the myth of the nice Kennedy boys. I remember Bobby Kennedy. He said, don't get mad, get even.
Oh, Bobby Kennedy was very, very...
He was working on Fidel's case.
Oh, absolutely.
Personally.
Under the Kennedy administration, the most of the assassination attempts against Fidel. And
oddly,
Bobby Kennedy was worse than Robert. Robert JFK got his cigars, so he was okay.
Yes.
But Bobby Kennedy was very, very intense to get rid of Fidel.
Now, and again, on this theme about expecting hope from the liberals, in terms of policy, Cuba is as likely to see a change under a Republican as a Democrat, in my opinion, because the liberals have proved themselves over time. I mean, take Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who would have to be a classic American liberal Democrat. He formed that thing, Americans for Democratic Action. My understanding is, for example, C. Wright Mills was a member of that. And he was expelled from the organization because he went to one of their meetings and stood up and spoke. And they brought the hammer down on him as a liberal Democrat. But meanwhile, but still, the illusion about the American liberal persists. I mean, and could you talk, by the way, about Arthur Schlesinger and some of the stuff he did?
And it's one of the fallacies of the left, who hope to see some rationality from the Americans in regards to Cuba, because there were such great expectations when Obama won.
Yes.
The Cubans were very excited too, because they felt, okay, now we have someone who understands and will actually move towards normalization. Mm. But bipartisanship ends at the shores of the United States when it comes to foreign policy.
That, by the way, is a line that they used to repeat openly. They don't say it so much anymore, but it
definitely
does.
No, but it's absolutely true in the case of Cuba, because you go through Republicans, you go through Democrats. Bill Clinton signed the Helms-Burton Act. Mm-hmm. The only one who had a shade of moderation was Jimmy Carter. And he didn't last too long.
Yeah,
and then Ronald Reagan came in and went right back to the worst parts of it. So
he played one in Hollywood. He must be real.
So Democrat or Republican, I don't think it matters. The closest the travel restrictions came to being ended through Congress was in 2010, and it was thwarted by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a Democrat, mm-hmm. simply because it maintains American policy, and it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. In the sense, George Bush Jr. was much harder on Cuba than Obama was, but in relative terms, the embargo's still there. In some ways, Obama is worse. He's applying more pressures on international banks and fining more international banks for doing business with Cuba, and that's well below the radar system. Very few people know about.
Yeah, I assume that in the powerful circles he travels in, this is one of the files that they're going to judge him on. In other words, does he get the job done with Cuba? Rather than, is he going to give them, make concessions to Cuba? Will he change that government?
Well, and the perception is now that Obama is in his second term. He has nothing to lose. He should, after 2014 in the midterms, that he will finally reveal his true feelings about Cuba and work towards normalization. It's not going to happen because Florida is still an important state for the Democrats.
Oh, that brings up a very important point. We're going to take a break and we're going to come back and talk to Keith, but I definitely want to take you up on this, on the matter of Florida. We're talking to Keith Bolander, and the book is Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution, and Its People. You can get that at a different book list, and we'll be right back. And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and we're talking to Keith Bolander, author of Cuba Under Siege, American Policy, the Revolution, and Its People. And I hope you get a copy. It's a very, very powerful book, very persuasive book. And I want to say, Keith, that you were raising a point about, well, what we call the Florida lobby, which we mean the Miami Cubans. And a scary bunch of people, by the way. However, there's a wonderful quote in your book from Mr. Alarcon, who writes very – he really makes persuasive arguments. And he says, the Cuba lobby is really an arm of the U.S. government. It's not the other way around. He said they use the Cuba lobby to twist their arm. They say, we'd like to be nice to you, Cuba, but we have these guys in Florida. We're all afraid of Florida.
It's the face.
He says it's not true.
It's the face of Cuban policy. Yes. Because American aggression against Cuba started in months after the triumph of the revolution. The Cuban lobby, which is mostly recognized as the Cuban American National Foundation, wasn't born until the early 1980s under tremendous amount of government financing under Reagan. So American policy hostility against Cuba was well established for 20 years before the Cuban lobby. Yeah. They are the continuation. They are I said in my book, they're the horn of American policy, but the engine still remains
in
Washington.
And it's also part of the pretense of what a democratic country it is, and saying, you see, we'd like to, but they have these votes.
Now, it's very effective.
Because he makes also the point. He says the same is true also of Israel. He said that lobby, everybody always talks about the Israeli lobby, but he says that's also the face of the American government. It's their policy. It's not the other way around, which is very, very important. And by the way, and this speaks to something else. Another issue, which is, I think, is probably one of the basic things in the U.S. position. They always say, well, you have a one-party system. Therefore, you can't, you know, that's entirely wrong and bad, et cetera. However, in the United States, we have a gentleman like Ralph Nader and so many others who say, well, we have what is called a two-party system. It's not a three-party or four-party. It's a two-party. And the problem is you can't tell the difference between the two parties.
It's a two-party dictatorship, and both parties are obliged to the business community.
And you foreign policy. I mean, differences stop at the border.
Stop at the border, yeah. And that's one of the other misconceptions about Cuba. They have the Cuban Communist Party is not a political party in the sense of what we know it, and there are elections, and there is a system. It's totally alien to our Western experiences, but it's what the Cubans have, and it's one of the other misconceptions of how you define democracy. The Americans are very good at definitions. What is freedom? What is democracy?
Yes.
What is civil rights? What are human rights? And they control the message, and so it's very difficult to get that
a catechism.
It's so hard, and I hope the book sort of brings out the Cubans' perspective, whether you agree with
it or not. Well, they've been a great corrective, I believe, since from day one. Fidelismo was one of the healthiest things to develop in this hemisphere, because Fidel knew about the Americans, turned out, better than they knew themselves. If you look at history, will absolve me. He's quoting Abraham Lincoln. And Americans don't tend to quote Lincoln, actually. They say they revere him, but they don't quote him much.
Well, they'll watch movies about him.
They watch movies about him, which it turned out to be kind of like Obama. You say, gee, I didn't realize how much Lincoln was like Obama. one of the things that's been the healthiest is the survival of the voice of Cuba challenging historiography in America. I mean, who knows the hemisphere best? Who's in command of history? When Fidel talks, you point out he's drawing on 400 years of history, not on just him and U.S. and Cuba. The whole story of the hemisphere.
Fidel didn't happen in a vacuum, which again the Americans try and portray that all of a sudden everything was perfect in Cuba until Fidel came around and messed things up. His revolution and Cuban nationalism that evolved from that goes back to 400 years when Cuba was first a colony of Spain and then became a neo-colony of the United States. Mm-hmm. There was a revolution in 1933 that tried to establish real Cuban nationalism, and the Americans thwarted it. Fidel is the embodiment of that success, that the revolution did succeed, and the Americans have been scared to death. One of the main reasons why they isolated Fidel was the threat of it. It expanding and into Latin America. And
now, you just described a moment ago that here they were, Gorbachev and the West reached an agreement, and as you say, suddenly there was a ton of books saying, oh, it's over, and how will we develop back? How will we return? And let's not be too arrogant that we will take over and run the place. But meanwhile, people of South America, Central America, were holding their breath. And then they exhaled, and Fidel and the Cubans went on. And look at Hugo Chavez and
20 years later,
all these people.
Yeah. Latin America is a much different place
Their
now.
Hearts were not broken.
Yeah.
Bolivar went, and others came, and they went.
And Latin America is in a different reality politically and economically now. And they are saying, America, you have your place, but it's not in our house. We want to keep you at arm's length, and it's actually being developed. And Cuba has more respect now, in my opinion, in Latin America than they have almost since the beginning of the revolution.
I think so. For example, this is going to be coming up, and I would imagine Cuba will play a starring role. We'll see. But we now, we're having once again a difference of opinion between the country of Argentina and Britain about the Malvinas. And my memory is that Fidel and Cuba startled everyone by saying, well, of course, Argentina's right. And even though that's a junta, even though those guys are right wing, they're right. And I recall that the foreign minister of Argentina paid a call on Havana, and it was also reciprocated, where they said, we're together against the British, a claim on this. Now, that really had to resonate in South America.
And Fidel has been consistent.
Absolutely.
He has been consistent.
He's not a petty guy. He doesn't say, oh, you were bad to me, I'm not going to support you.
Right.
He said, when you're right, you're right.
And his judgments on what's best for Latin America have been consistent. What's best for Cuba have been consistent. They haven't always been delicate. They haven't always been well received. But he has been a champion of Latin American rights and the ability to separate from American hegemony. And you're seeing that now. It's a very exciting time in Latin America.
Yeah, and we now have a pope who he's an ambivalent status, but he is an Argentine, and the president of Argentina has already said, please remind the British and the Americans of whose territory that is.
And that's important.
And if he does, if he takes any kind of stand at all, the British and the Americans are going to have a real headache on their hands.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, not at all. No, because, there's a great quote from Benito Juarez. He says, mutual respect is peace. If America would show mutual respect, they could be the big flower in the flower bed, but they can't be the only flower.
Yeah, that's very apt. And that's one thing they've never shown Cuba since the revolution.
Or anybody else.
Respect.
So many Americans, and you cite Noam Chomsky and others, but they've all been healthy on this point. Becoming an empire was fatal for the American democracy. It is America that has a problem with having decided it had the right to be an empire.
And what's worse is the Americans deny it.
And they deny it to themselves.
They don't acknowledge it.
Yeah. And you say, well, you're out,
And that's the worst.
You're out in the woods without your trousers and you're drunk, but you're not there, right?
But everything's fine.
You're fine. And you're just a regular guy. Nobody's accusing you.
The emperor really has no clothes.
No, everything is dandy. I want to ask you some questions about the early days of this great revolution, which is still unfolding, in fact. And this is Keith Bollander, and the book is Cuba Under Siege. This whole misreading of who Fidel was, when he came on the scene, a beautiful figure, very persuasive man. By the way, many Americans were infatuated with him, and that took a lot of beating on the drums and whatnot to quiet it all down. But it was clear people understood what he was. He was a patriot. And he was a caring person, and he was obviously loved by people. The scenes of him coming into Havana and the crowds, you just could not make that up. It was happening. And the PR people went on a real rampage to turn that around. But they immediately called him a communist. And he said, well, I'm not a communist, but I have these principles. Then they said, well, okay, well, we're going to really bring the hammer down. And then he went through a process of becoming what he called a Marxist-Leninist. Watching that, people said, well, you see, he was all along. But actually, he had quite a run-in with Blas Roca, and more importantly, a man named Aníbal Escalante, one I remember.
Escalante, yeah. Hubert Matos as well.
Yeah.
That history, we're still seeing the effect of it today.
These were, I should say, leaders of the Communist Party of Cuba who somehow...
Fidel was never a member of the Communist Party of Cuba.
Yeah.
In fact, the Communist Party of Cuba... rejected Fidel's tactics, and only until it was very clear that Fidel was on the winning side that the Communist Party started to get cozy with him, and Fidel reorganized it completely.
Yeah, he actually, was a source of political havoc around the world because, of course, many people wanted to be Fidelistas. My view, you could look at Nelson Mandela as somebody very much influenced by Fidel, who said to the Communist Party of South Africa, hey, that may not be a bad idea.
The first person Mandela thanked after he got out of prison was Fidel.
Yeah.
But the Americans...
There's a lot of people could line up and thank the guy.
But Mandela was a terrorist organization.
Absolutely.
under American terminology. Fidel was perceived fairly early on as not someone who the Americans could control. And the State Department had many reports saying there's no indication that he was a communist, but he's not going to be Batista light. He's going his own way. So then the idea was, well, we have to portray him in the worst possible way. Yes. And the worst possible way in the late 1950s was you're a communist.
Yes.
And then, of course, the conflict between Cuba and the United States when the nationalizations took place and the sugar quota was ended. It just led an easy move to the Americans to put the dialogue, well, look, he's a communist.
Yeah,
way before he had established any...
In a way, it's interesting how people had this focus, I think left, right, and center, on the issue of communism, when in the U.S. was most worried by people who didn't obey. And that was a much more dangerous... I mean, after all, the man that was on the top of their list in the Middle East was Abdel Nasser, who was not a communist either. But he had a similar issue that Fidel had, which is he was a patriot. And he wanted the best for his people. He was going to find a way to do it.
And there's a number of examples of how the Americans treat that type of politician. You look 5 years before the revolution in Guatemala when Arbenz was overthrown in 1954.
Yes.
And in Iran. So the Americans have a long history of saying, if you don't play our game, we're going to change the rules and get rid of you. So Fidel was very much aware of that.
And by the way, on this thing, you mentioned Guatemala. We all know, I think, the story of Che Guevara was... He had been in Guatemala, and certainly he had the personal experience. He could say, don't trust these guys.
It's a very good point. He had the ear of Fidel, and he said, you know, this revolution is going to be violently opposed by the Americans simply because of the relationship. Where, you know, and Fidel was very willing to negotiate, accommodate, but it came pretty clear that it was America's control over Cuba that they just did not want to lose. And when they started losing it, there was very little room to negotiate or compromise.
Yep. Well, let's see. This time has gone really fast. This is Keith Bolander, and his book is Cuba Under Siege: American Policy and Revolution and Its People, and that's Paul Grave Macmillan. Let me just say, given Venezuela and developments, Brazil, Argentina, et cetera, what is your prognosis? Cuba, does it have the options that it appears to have in terms of development and staying out of this diktat from the United States? Because the U.S. It doesn't appear to be mature enough to change.
The relationship with Cuba and the rest of the world has changed, and they're dealing with every other country. But they have to normalize relations with the United States, or more directly, the Americans have to normalize relations with Cuba for the revolution to fulfill what it really, its potential. Mm-hmm. I think it'll happen politically in Miami as the Cuban Americans the dynamics and the demographics are changing, as the younger generation of Cuban Americans want to engage. It won't happen overnight, but there's signs that there's positive signs that it will change.
Well, now on that, and we still, I see, have a little more time, and I'll take advantage of it. You know, here you have a great patriot. I mean, if you're a young Cuban-American, you have to go out on the street every day, and you have your own identity, and you talk to people and whatnot, and inevitably you have pride, right?
Well, the younger generation of Cubans who left for the United States lived under the revolution. Yeah. So they've seen the social justice programs, and they want to maintain their contacts with their families and friends. Yeah. They're not the first generation who lost.
Well, maybe we'll get a new Florida from them.
I think you might.
A good Florida, one that wants education and Medicare. This has been Keith Bolander. We're really glad. I'm going to ask him to sign my book.